Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov. Welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we bring together national speakers to talk about critical issues in electronic discovery and records management at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and at a time when people are interested in the topic, regardless of where they're located, because you can just click and listen to a show when you want to. Today, we're talking about questions every in-house attorney needs to know the answers to about records management, which is a topic that most e-discovery attorneys agree could make the life of clients less stressful if they focus on records management of ESI before litigation hits them. Unfortunately, most don't for a variety of reasons. Today's panelist is someone I've presented with live before on a number of occasions, and we both were contributing authors in a PBI press book called eDiscovery, published in September 2008. Tom Smith is the panelist, and he's practiced at K&L Gates since 1987. He's a partner in the firm's Pittsburgh office. Tom concentrates his practice in the area of complex commercial litigation. He's a founding member of the firm's eDiscovery Analysis and Technology, EDAT group, and regularly counsels clients in matters involving complex records preservation and collection issues, litigation holds, and e-discovery and records management retention policies. He also regularly speaks at national and regional conferences on records management and e-discovery issues. Tom, thanks for joining us on the show.
You're welcome, Carl.
Well, before we get started, sort of gotten into a canned question here that I ask every panelist. How did you get started in electronic discovery?
I actually got into it so I could speak on panels where you sing songs about electronic discovery, Carl. But
Dave Cohen, your partner, wrote that song. I should give him the rights. that's on ESI Bytes.
Is it really?
Yeah. Could you bring me your paper or something like that?
Yes.
Go
right,
ahead.
Right. Anyway, I mean, I've been a litigator at K&L for 22 years, and right off the bat in my career, I got involved in large, comprehensive litigations involving environmental issues, insurance coverage issues. And back in the late 80s, that still involved typically hundreds and hundreds of boxes of documents in every case. And very early on, we started looking for ways to manage that process more efficiently and more cost effectively. I remember as a second-year associate excitedly telling the partner on the case that I had found that there is a way to avoid the copying and Bates numbering of our hundreds of boxes of documents, and that was by microfilming them. That was kind of a cutting-edge process where the documents would be microfilmed and at the same time have a number assigned to them, so we could not use clerks to put little stickers on all the pages. So that seems like a century ago, and it was only 20 years ago. And then rapidly, of course, things started to change, and the landscape of discovery in every case started to swing towards production of emails and electronic records. And so along with my partner, who you mentioned, Dave Cohen, we started here at the firm something back then that we called our Automated Litigation Support Group to help us, Dave and I both, and others in the firm, litigate these large matters. Pretty soon, that litigation support group kind of took on a life of its own, and we started becoming advisors within the firm to all of our litigation colleagues. And eventually, about 6 or 7 years ago, that mushroomed into a separate practice group that we called back then Records Management, an e-discovery and records management practice group. And now it's called our EDAT group, Electronic Discovery Analysis and Technology group. And while I still litigate regularly, much of my practice, in fact, the majority of it, is in advising clients on records management and e-discovery issues.
Before we jump into some of the questions, who is involved in this dialogue or trying to understand records management and establishing an e-discovery ready records management program or process?
Well, in-house counsel is always involved, but in most instances, the IT function is also involved. Sometimes compliance function personnel will be involved. And many organizations have somebody that's in a dedicated records management function. Sometimes that person has maybe records management is one-third of his or her job, but they're given responsibility for records management. So that's kind of the primary universe of folks that get involved in these issues.
And why is it important for a company to know who's involved in establishing these programs or processes?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. What we see very frequently, what I see out advising clients on these issues, is that primarily legal and IT are the two functions that should most directly be involved in records management and e-discovery readiness. And those two functions are frequently ships passing in the night within companies. I can't tell you how many times I've had a situation where we've been asked to come in and give some, do an assessment of a company's records management practices and e-discovery readiness. And in setting up that meeting, I'll say, let's make sure we have someone from IT there as well as the in-house counsel. And I'll quickly learn once we're at the meeting that this is the first time that IT and legal have actually talked directly about these issues. And often you'll find that IT has taken steps that it thinks is assisting the company to become e-discovery ready. But the in-house counsel actually would have done something completely different. A perfect example is in the amendments to the federal rules at the end of 06, which now there's analogous rules across the country in various state rule books. You have the ability to perhaps mitigate your burdens in discovery by not having to produce electronically stored information that is, quote, not reasonably accessible, end quote. And yet, you'll find that a lot of IT functions who are also out there, just like the lawyers are, going to all sorts of e-discovery and records management conferences, the IT folks are out there going to similar conferences, and they come back thinking that their mandate is to make sure that everything that the company receives or generates electronically is saved, and is saved forever, and is saved in a way that can be easily retrievable. Well, if the lawyer in the company at some point in some litigation hopes to avoid some massive discovery burden by relying on that not reasonably accessible language, the IT function may have just taken that away from counsel by making everything in the company easily and readily accessible. And as soon as the litigation adversary learns about that, they start to tell the court, well, there's no burden for the discovery that we're seeking from this company, Judge. And so we want the world because they can get the world to us in a push of a button. Well, that may be true that there's not a lot of costs associated with retrieving the information if you have some incredibly robust, say, archiving system that archives all emails across the company. But once you collect all that, now you have to review it before you produce it. You have to review it for privilege. You have to review it for responsiveness. And the cost can be overwhelming. And so that is a classic example that I see all the time where IT and legal don't coordinate early in the process and decisions are made that might ultimately be detrimental to the company.
Well, let's talk about some more of these questions whether the company can answer them. Why is it important for the company to know, does the company have a records management policy?
Well, records management documents are assets of the company, and and it's just critical to have kind of a constitution, so to speak, for how records within a company are going to be handled. They guide the employees with how long, as to how long these records should be kept. These policies will often assign responsibility to who is responsible to keep the quote-unquote original record. And if employees know that another function is responsible for retaining certain records, then they similarly know that they don't have to retain those records. And that way you eliminate having duplicates across the company. Sometimes, you know, dozens and dozens of the same exact document are kept throughout the company because there's not a clear understanding of who's responsible to do what and to keep what. It's critical for, there's been many instances where I've asked in-house counsel in an initial assessment, do you have a records management policy? And they kind of shrug because they're not sure. They think that the finance department had some kind of policy, but they're not sure if it's been used. That's unacceptable. Records are so important. You have to have a policy, and it has to be a deliberate, conscious decision that's been made as to how a company's records will be handled.
Has the company implemented and enforced a record retention schedule?
That's another very important question that certainly in-house counsel should know the answer to. If you don't know the answer to that as in-house counsel, it's very likely that you don't have a schedule because counsel are typically involved in putting together these schedules. And if you don't have a schedule, then it's likely that your company is retaining records far beyond any legally mandated retention period. And that means additional storage costs, true, but maybe the greater cost is a lack of productivity and efficiency when every time somebody goes to search for some record, they have to wade through literally, you know, terabytes worth of data that doesn't need to be retained. And of course, kind of a hidden cost is the great risk that exists in the litigation context if there are all sorts of records that have been retained that didn't need to be retained. One of the risks is that there'll be harmful information in there that you didn't have to have in your possession anymore. But even if that's not the case, as I alluded to earlier, if you have all that information and you're forced to produce it in discovery, it just drives up the cost of review and production in discovery. And I mean, it drives it up exponentially. So in-house counsel needs to know the answer to whether you have a record retention schedule.
Does the company have systems to manage retention schedules?
Right. Another very important question, because there are many systems that will track retention periods. Now, these are still relatively new. I mean, effective automated systems for tracking retention, but they are developing, and especially if you're a large company, it often makes sense to explore whether to use resources to procure some kind of automated system that will help you manage your record retention. And what that really means is be able to get rid of records as soon as possible that you don't need to keep. By the way, most kinds of records have no legally mandated retention period. And so when a record retention system is being developed, the focus should be on what kind of records do we have that there is some statute or regulation that requires us to keep these records for a certain amount of time. And then beyond that, of course, if there's litigation, you have to implement a litigation hold. And beyond that, you may have some strong business desire to keep certain kinds of records. But all other records should be disposed of as soon as they're, you know, no longer being used or needed.
And we did a previous podcast with Jim Eichowitz on just on the last step of deleting records at the end of a litigation. It's something that a lot of people don't think about.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, moving into another set of questions, you know, what are the company's procedures regarding records holds?
Yeah, that's a good question, and also, you know, whether certain employees should have specific responsibilities regarding holds. If in-house counsel does not know the answer to the question, do you have a procedure for implementing litigation holds and who has responsibilities for those procedures, then in-house counsel has some remedial work to do, because in-house counsel needs to know first whether the company has a procedure. And if the answer to that question is no, then in-house counsel should get that procedure put in place promptly. In almost all litigation these days, you're going to get questions in discovery about what steps did you take to preserve records, primarily electronic records. How did you do that? Did you issue a litigation hold? In many litigations now, you'll be asked to produce a copy of your litigation hold notice that went out to employees. There's issues about whether you should do that, whether it's privileged, but even if you keep it, even if you withhold it as privileged, you should have litigation hold notices. Additionally, you should have a consistent, defensible process for issuing litigation holds. In each litigation, you should follow the same steps to get those litigation holds out the door. You should have a way to track them and make sure that the right people got them and that they're implementing them. It'd be a topic for another podcast to get into what all the components of a good litigation hold procedure should be, but what we're talking about today is the fact that in-house counsel must know whether you have a procedure and must know what that procedure requires.
And actually, we did do a podcast on that with John Jablonski on legal holds. He blogs on that topic. It's a great, it's such an important topic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what type of systems does the company use to track litigation holds?
I mean, there are a variety of systems. There are systems that, again, you can get on the market. Some of them, I think, are very expensive and are much more than many companies need. In some instances, companies will use their outside counsel. If you have outside counsel that handles a lot of your litigation, maybe you have a certain firm that handles, you know, your employment cases, sometimes the outside counsel can track the holds for you. And sometimes the IT function will do some kind of tracking of the holds by using the, if you send the holds out by email, they'll use the red receipt option on the toolbar and do some tracking that way. There are many ways to skin that cat, but you need to find a way to track your holds so that you can lift the holds when the litigation or investigation is over.
Okay, let's move into a new area here. Here's I think, an interesting question. Does the company use any email archiving, journaling, and or other systems that retains email messages apart and beyond what individual users may retain them? Why is this important?
Well, often few in a company might know of all the systems used to store and backup and archive email. And if in-house counsel is learning in the midst of some litigation matter, if in-house counsel is learning for the first time that, oh, you mean we have an archive of all of our emails and they go back 7 years and it's entirely searchable, that's a bad place to be learning that during litigation. In-house counsel should know whether there's any archiving or journaling system in place within the company. If there is not, in-house counsel should make sure that he or she is involved in any consideration of such a tool, because sometimes the conclusion will be you don't want it, you don't need it. Or if it's concluded that you do need it, then, or if you find that you already have it, then you might want to, you definitely would want to, as in-house counsel, get involved in a discussion about how long should all those emails be retained. Is there a reason to retain them longer than a year or 6 months or 3 months? Is there a way to make sure that you generally don't retain all of the emails for a long time, except for things that users affirmatively move into a folder or some other a PST file or off to another server to retain for particular purposes? These are all questions that in-house counsel should be asking and finding answers to.
Tom, based on your experience, what do you think these systems, oftentimes people are looking for the easy button, okay?
Right.
And, does the company use that email archiving system to search for ESI as a primary method?
Yeah.
What do you see in that area?
A lot of companies are starting to do that. The problem that I see from a litigation standpoint is that these tools are making it incredibly easy to save everything and search everything. And like I said before, while there might not be a lot of costs associated with doing the search of everything, because as you say, Carl, you press the easy button and run the search, and some of the search tools in these archiving solutions are very powerful search tools. But the problem is that no matter how narrow you try to do your search, when you're accumulating data that gets up into hundreds of gigabytes or terabytes, your search results are going to pull back the equivalent of hundreds or thousands of boxes worth of documents, the electronic equivalent of that. And now you're stuck having to figure out how to do privilege reviews, how to do responsiveness reviews, how to code that information for use in your case. And if you save an entire, let's say, planet worth of information, then no matter how good your searches are, you're going to end up with several mountain ranges of information that needs to be reviewed. So I challenge the premise that you should save everything because these days you can, and that you should save everything because these days you can search it easily. Because when you save everything, you end up with a huge chunk of everything every time you're in discovery, and it just drastically drives up the costs at every stage of discovery after you run your search. The collection costs, the review costs, the privilege review costs, the cost of assembling a privilege review, the cost of production, whether it's TIFFing or however you're going to do your production, every single cost is driven up exponentially, all because somebody decided, hey, let's save everything because we can.
And the challenges of these tools to keep up with the pace of change and where documents reside and their format, and then be able to search across them is a battle that's very hard for any system to win.
Right.
In fact, I haven't heard of a system that has won that battle yet.
Right. That's right.
So humans are real important in this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, to what extent is the business use of portable electronic media such as laptops, thumb drives, and disks allowed, monitored, and or limited by the company? Why is that important?
That's another question that in-house counsel has to know. In-house counsel has to know if a departing employee might have a thumb drive that contains sensitive company data on it, so that in-house counsel can make sure that in the employee departure procedures, there's something that says, make sure we get all thumb drives or other portable storage devices that this employee either has been given as part of his job while he's working there or would have access to put information onto. Many of these portable devices lack password protection or encryption chronology, and make security issues or raise security issues. And records stored on such portable media can be easily overlooked when a company is collecting data in response to a discovery request or a governmental investigation. So it's critical that in-house counsel know if employees have such portable devices. It's critical that in-house counsel know whether the company has a policy about employees using such portable devices, what that policy is. These are all important questions for in-house counsel to be aware of.
Another focused area is, to what extent is the business use of instant messaging and text messaging allowed, monitored, and or limited by the company?
Right. I mean, I have been in meetings kind of wearing my hat as a litigator, and I'm sitting in a meeting with in-house counsel and a potential witness, and I say to the potential witness, now, do you use IM? And the in-house counsel jumps in and says, oh, well, we don't use IM here. We have a policy against IM that prohibits the use of IM. And the witness kind of shrugs and says, well, actually, you know, I downloaded it from AOL and I use it all the time. And a lot of us do in our department because it's a great tool. And then in-house counsel, you know, is embarrassed that they didn't know that. But more than their embarrassment, they're now concerned about what does that mean for purposes of litigation. When in-house counsel did the litigation hold, she didn't specifically say to save any IM because she didn't think anyone was using IM. Same thing with text messaging. People listening to this podcast are probably aware of the problem that the mayor of Detroit had, where he had an affair with somebody on his staff, and they were text messaging back and forth, and they were deleting the text messages and thought that that meant no one would ever see them, but they were being captured on a backup system and created serious problems for Mr. Mayor up there in Detroit. In-house counsel needs to know whether employees are using text messaging for business purposes. Obviously, it's becoming more and more commonplace for that to happen, and in-house counsel needs to know if that's happening and think about how to handle that, both with regard to the company's records management policy, what should the policy be, and what about litigation? How do you address that in your litigation hold?
Anyone with teenagers knows there's lots of bad stuff in text messages.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, the next generation of the workforce is going to be text messaging like crazy. Instant messaging is already passe for most high school and college students, and they're doing text messaging, and
people don't talk anymore. They just text multiple people.
Right. And so when those folks are in the workforce, that's how they'll be communicating to business colleagues, and that's something in-house counsel's going to need to be aware of and on top of.
Well, let's go on to the next teenage issue, which will impact businesses. To what extent is the business use of electronic bulletin boards, web logs, and social networking sites allowed, monitored, and or limited by the company? Why is that an important question?
Well, I had a recent situation with a client where it started off as a really good thing, where employees took admirable initiative to form a group, and they met on Facebook, and they would join together. They were engineers from, and it's a global company, so engineers in the similar discipline from locations around the world joined online and had this kind of weekly chat where they would share their ideas with each other to help themselves in their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
It was an excellent idea. They weren't getting paid extra for doing this. And the purpose of it was to help them do better in their jobs. Well, they took the company logo and pasted it onto the site. And then they made, during these chats, sometimes they'd be very critical of the company about certain things. And then this site became public. Well, it was public, but it came to somebody else's attention, a shareholder. And I won't go into all the details, but some serious issues arose where it appeared that the company was being critical of a certain people in the company, and it appeared to be kind of an official company website, were criticizing certain management decisions of that company, and it became a very awkward and troublesome issue.
Hmm.
So an in-house counsel had no idea, and how could he have? He wasn't in the group. No one told him about this. He had no idea that employees were doing this. And so that, of course, spawned an investigation into are there other similar situations like this? And in fact, there were dozens of them. Dozens of employees were doing things like this on various social networking sites. So they asked us to help them write changes to their policy and get out some communications to employees about this. And it's a very naughty issue.
Well,
K-N-O-T-T-Y.
Yeah. If the lawyers aren't talking to their IT staff, they're surely not talking to their engineers either.
Right, right.
Well, let's look back in time. We were looking forward in time. What legacy systems and media exist at the company that may still contain electronically stored information? You know, why is this important?
Well, this kind of segues into backup tape issues as well, where the companies will have legacy systems or often legacy backup tapes that contain who knows what information. Once these legacy systems became legacy and were no longer being used, ideally at that moment the company would have taken steps to figure out what's on those systems. And in fact, what happens in most instances like that is there is an effort made, a necessary effort made at that point, to move from the legacy systems any data that's necessary for the business. So at that point, when you move whatever's necessary, somebody's looking at what else is on there, and a decision could have been made, hey, we don't need this, we can get rid of it. But instead, it's human nature, just like we do at home. You know, we buy a new TV, instead of just getting rid of the old TV, you kind of put it in the basement in case you need it or whatever. Well, companies do the same thing. Well, we're not going to do anything with this now. We'll just put it in a storage room. And over time, that storage room becomes jam-packed with all sorts of legacy systems, legacy backup tapes. Now you're in some litigation. And in discovery, somebody testifies in a deposition that, oh, yeah, we have a bunch of stuff down in the big storage room in the warehouse, old computers, old backup tapes. Now the other side starts pushing for, they say, well, those legacy systems were from, you know, the 1970s, and that's when the matters at issue in this case took place. So, Judge, we think they should have to restore the information on those legacy systems and backup tapes and produce them. And if you're forced to do something like that, the expenses are unbelievable. It's kind of like if anybody remembers the old 8-track tapes. Well, if you have an 8-track tape, you know, of the Beatles, and you want to play it, first you have to go find an 8-track player. And similarly with legacy backup tapes, a lot of times these tapes are sitting around and you can't do anything with them unless you somehow find that old 8-track player that will play them. And the expenses are extraordinary. Of course, you have arguments to the court about the extraordinary burdens, and you try to avoid producing that. It's not reasonably accessible. But the whole time you're making all those arguments, you're thinking, I wouldn't even have needed to do any of this, make these arguments, if somebody had just gotten rid of this legacy stuff when they could have. So in-house counsel needs to know, do we have such legacy systems? Do we have such legacy backup tapes? And if so, start working on a plan to get rid of that stuff if it's not needed for anything.
Boy, whenever I think of backup tapes, I'm going to think of that Good Times comedian with Dynamite, where everybody is A-tracks.
That's
commercials.
Right.
Anyway, let's talk about offsite storage. Why is it important for the in-house legal department to know are any records being stored offsite, and what records management practices are being followed regarding
in-house,
those documents?
Good question. I mean, it's a good question that in-house counsel needs to know. In-house counsel needs to know when there's an investigation, a governmental investigation, or even an internal investigation, or, of course, discovery and litigation. In-house counsel needs to know where to look to find everything that might be responsive. In-house counsel needs to, working with outside counsel, be sure to have a witness prepared, a 30B6 type witness who would be able to testify that the company looked where they should look and preserved what they should preserve in connection with the discovery. And that obviously means that in-house counsel needs to know whether there's offsite storage, how that offsite storage is managed, how you can retrieve stuff from the offsite location, and that includes, of course, electronic information that now is backup tapes are sent offsite. Sometimes old servers are sent to offsite storage locations. In-house counsel needs to know if that's happening, and if so, why is it happening, and how long is such information being retained offsite? And in many cases, they'll find that the answer is, oh, it's just being retained indefinitely. Or they'll find that the answer is, oh, there's a very strict retention period and everything's going to be destroyed in 5 years. And then in-house counsel needs to inquire, well, is there anything there older than 5 years right now? And usually the answer will be yes, because the stuff isn't actually disposed of when it's supposed to be. Again, in-house counsel will be in a bad spot if they learn in the middle of litigation with some aggressive adversary that's trying to drive up your costs to force a settlement, if that's when in-house counsel first learns that there's just a entire aircraft carrier worth of information in some offsite location that's been retained far beyond when it needed to be retained.
I have a great example on that. A good friend is in charge of e-discovery and litigation at a financial institution, and there was a movement about looking back in the history of lending organizations with the slave trade and being involved in that area and disclosing and researching. And this attorney looked and realized they had records back into the 1800s and boxes of them, which were they weren't sure what were in these boxes, but that was the era they had to inquire into, and it was sort of vexing, and it could have been easily solved by not holding on to a lot of that stuff.
Right.
I think that
in the vast majority of the cases that I've litigated over the years, if really old documents pop up that there was no obligation to retain, in most instances, the company is saying, darn, I wish we still didn't have that around. It's the rare instance where they say, well, I'm glad we kept that. That's just the reality. Old documents, it's not necessarily that they are some devastating smoking gun. It's just that they're a document that there's no one around that can explain it, no one around that can put it in context, because it's from 1957, and the language is ambiguous, but your adversary starts using it against you, and you don't have anybody that can help you explain it away, because it's so old, and you're just left thinking, why did I have this? And as frequently as that problem has arisen in the world of paper, it's going to arise, exponentially more in the electronic world as so many companies are just keeping electronic information on backup tapes or otherwise far beyond any legal requirement to do so.
I'm not sure if we have anything to add to the off-site storage of third parties being responsible for managing records on behalf of the company, given the Facebook's examples. But do you have anything else you wanted to add on that?
Often off-site storage locations are managed by third parties, you know, Iron Mountain-type places, and they often have their own procedures for handling things. And it's important for in-house counsel to know what the third-party vendors' procedures are for handling the company's records. Many third parties are hosting large volumes of electronic data for companies now. In many litigations, companies will hire a third-party vendor to do all the hosting of all the documents that are going to be produced in the case. When the case is over, what's that third-party vendor going to do with those documents? How can you be sure that they destroy them if that's what they're supposed to do? These are all questions in-house counsel should be on top of. We're giving a lot of jobs to in-house counsel today.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's the reality that in-house counsel needs to know the answer to these questions. And they might not need to know every minute detail about these things, but they need to have an understanding across records management and e-discovery that there are all these issues percolating, and they should assess that, and they should get help, whether it's internal resources, outside counsel, consultants, to come in and help them to get their ducks in a row on these issues.
Well, you know, people leave companies all the time, and when an employee departs a company, what steps does a company take to ensure the proper management of records once managed by that departed employee?
Right.
Why is that important?
I mean, I've in litigation that I've been involved in where I've, you know, I'm sitting there with in-house counsel, and I say, okay, the other side is asking for, you know, all the emails of these 12 employees, and I found out that three of these are gone. So in-house counsel, you know, what's done with what happened with the emails of those three employees? And in-house counsel often kind of shrugs. I don't know. We'll have to check with IT to see. I don't know what the process is. Well, in-house counsel should know what that process is, because especially if you're in a company where the litigation profile is such that there are litigation matters generally ongoing, and three floors down, IT is going into some departed employee's office and taking their computer and wiping it clean to give that hardware to a new employee. In-house counsel should know that. In-house counsel should know, are there steps that are taken first to determine whether that employee, the departing employee, is subject to any litigation holds or has other data that the company needs to retain? And what are the steps that are taken? And who decides what that employee has that the company might need to keep? In-house counsel needs to be on top of that.
When an acquisition is completed, is records management process put into place?
Right. Another good question. And, you know,
because the employees often depart after that.
Yeah, and that's true. But, I mean, there are so many mergers and acquisitions going on all the time that in-house counsel needs to mesh whatever records management policies and processes the acquired company has or didn't have with the acquiring company's own, and you need to make that consistent and need to get folks on the same page. If you have different IT departments that are now part of the same company, you need to get them on the same page. And, you know, some in-house counsel take the position that this is really, IT has to work that all out. Well, there's plenty that IT has to work out that's purely IT-related functions. But IT definitely has a role in records management and e-discovery readiness, and so does in-house counsel. So where that overlap exists, in-house counsel needs to stick her nose into the IT tent and make sure that IT is doing what, at least considering what in-house counsel wants. And if there is some real conflict between what IT thinks should be done, say regarding backup tapes, and what counsel thinks should be done, that should be aired and management should decide.
If we haven't pushed in-house counsel over the edge of the past 12 questions, so this 13th one, the last one might do it. You know, what privacy and confidential considerations are involved with records managed by the company? I guess for multinationals, this is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, there are one thing is there are a lot of HIPAA-related regulations regarding employees' personal health information. There are practices around responses to data breaches and when customers have to be informed of such breaches. Much of that is implicated specifically by various states' laws. Companies need to consider limiting access to sensitive business records like strategic plans, trade secrets, and limiting access to that on electronic systems. And in-house counsel needs to think about the vulnerabilities in electronic systems, including things like Bluetooth devices and even print servers. Often, print servers will retain confidential private data, and it's in the print server, and that can be accessed. You might have all these other servers that are very difficult to get into, unless, at least as to private information, unless you have certain security clearance. But there have been some situations where private information has been discovered on print servers. In-house counsel needs to think about where private information, trade secret information, proprietary employee health and personal information is retained within the company, who has access to it, and what laws apply to require you to protect it, and how is the company doing in that regard? In-house counsel needs to know the answers to those questions.
Well, great. Tom, thank you for being my guest here on ESI Bytes. This has been very informative and actually more interesting than I thought it was going to be when we talked about doing the records management. Is like starts with a or ends with a yawn at some point, but some very good colorful examples here to sort of bring it to life. Thanks for participating.
Sure, Carl.
And I'd like to also thank the listeners, and for a complete list of shows, if you're listening to this and you like this show, go to www.esibytes.com. And remember to visit ESI Bytes to learn tips about electronic discovery and records management before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman from Juranov. Have a nice day.
Thanks, Carl.